Philip Glass. He's one of those composers for whom all it takes is just a few notes, and you recognize his work. He is the master of minimalism, though Glass himself doesn't like the term. He prefers describing himself as a composer of music with repetitive structures. Philip Glass has composed dozens of operas. His most famous is arguably Einstein on the Beach. He's also composed symphonies and film scores. You watch The Hours or The Fog of War, and you hear Philip Glass. He's also written the new memoir, Words Without Music. It's a curious title for a composer, so when we talked to Philip Glass, this is what I ventured to ask. Well, the title of your memoir is Words Without Music. But I'm curious, I mean, if you were to compose the memoir of your life, instead of using words, using music, what would it sound like?
Magna, I've already done it. That's what I've done.
Your entire actually, body of work.
Of course. Any artist will tell you that their work in the end is autobiographical. Whoever we are, whatever we paint, whatever we do, as a friend of mine, we say, in a lifetime, we stand revealed. We stand revealed.
We can start by having you just put us in the shoes of a very young Philip Glass, I don't know, age 5, 6, 7, because you write about how when you were young, you used to sit on the stairs or in the back of the room when your father would listen to music late at night.
Yes. Well, I wasn't supposed to be awake, you see. I was up in the upstairs bedrooms, and I would come when he was home. He would get home from work late, and he would eat dinner, and then he would listen to music. He had a little radio shop, a record shop in Baltimore, Maryland. He would listen to music, and I was on the stairs listening with him. I never knew whether he was aware that I was actually there. Mm. But we listened to music together for years.
And what kind of music were you listening to together?
He was not a trained musician by any means, but he ended up being a great fan of chamber music. Most of the classic Schubert, Beethoven, Mozart, quartets, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I can say one thing that I'm very pleased about. When I was in my 30s and I was down visiting in Baltimore, I discovered that my first record was in the classical section under G.
It was.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I wanted to ask you about that because there's so many wonderful juxtapositions that you write about that sort of characterize your life. And one of them is this, that, you know, you grew up in 1940s Baltimore. I mean, your family wasn't affluent by any stretch of the imagination, but there was a certain richness to your home life with music through your father, progressive education through your mother. But there's a scrappiness there as well. I mean, you tell this wonderful story about how you started playing the flute and some boys, again, this is 1940s Baltimore, made, I guess, what I can call a puerile comment about it, about the flute. And your brother helps set up a fight so you can basically beat the crap out of these boys and prove your manliness.
I had no choice. I had no choice really because we had to walk home from school and I often had the flute with me. And I wasn't a kind of guy that got into fights. And there was only one fight and it never happened again after that. It's true, the family, we didn't have a lot of money, but my mother was a school teacher. She was an English teacher. And there was a kind of pride in education that came through her. I discovered later, I went to the University of Chicago very young. I was 15 when I went. And I always wondered why or how they let me do that, my parents. I was just a 15-year-old kid. But they did. And later, many, many years later, I was talking to my sister. And I said, why do you think they let me go to Chicago then? And she said, well, Ida, that was her mother's name, Ida wanted you to go. She said, Ben, that was my father. She said, Ben was against it, but Ida insisted that you go.
Huh. Yeah.
Isn't that amazing?
How much was music a calling for you at that time, before you went off to the University of Chicago?
Let's put it this way, Magna, I never considered doing anything else. It seems to me that I always knew I would be a musician. And the only problem was when that would start and when I would get the education I needed. And it began early. I began 6 and 7, which is, that's a normal age to start. I never considered any other occupation. I didn't really start writing until I was 15. But once I began, then the writing took over.
Yeah. You know, I love how you describe in those early years when you were a student at the University of Chicago. Again, you started when you were just 15, and you were traveling frequently between Baltimore and Chicago by train. And you write in the memoir that your way of hearing had been radically transformed in those years. How did it get transformed?
Was I referring to the train itself?
Yeah, the sounds of daily life, you said.
Yeah, this is the old B&O Railroad, and it was an overnight train. So in those days, there were no amenities on trains at all. There was no lights on at night. There was no club car where you could get a cup of coffee or anything like that. You just made friends with the night. That's what you did. The rhythm of the wheels hitting the track, the clickety-clack, clickety-clack, that's what you heard. Years later, I heard rhythms that sounded like that. And I think that actually the music of the trains became a kind of soundtrack for me as a very young guy. It's built into the way I listened then, and it's still there.
Well, in reading your book, you kind of frequently reflect on how people, experiences, and moments in your life really influence your way of hearing. And one of those revelations comes when you're in Chicago, when you just become immersed in jazz. I mean, you talk with like revelatory terms in the book about Charlie Parker, John Coltrane. I mean, what did you learn from them?
Well, the curious thing was that I loved that music, but I never played it myself. I was always a pencil and paper composer. I didn't improvise. But I was enamored with the music that came from the men and the women who were performing then. I was very fortunate. I heard Billie Holiday sing. I heard John Coltrane many times. I heard the bebop players of the 50s.
What really captured me about this part of the book is that you wrote that you only recently connected your music to jazz, which was interesting to me that it came as a surprise to you.
Well, you see, the world of concert music and classical music is so different in a certain way. Not fundamentally not that different, but I thought of that as a different world. So it was only years and years later, I mean, actually fairly recently, and I'm in my 70s now, we were doing Einstein on the Beach somewhere. It might have been in London. And I was listening to a piece in there called The Train, by the way. the Train, it was a piece called The Train. I was listening to that and I was saying, where have I heard that music before? And I finally remembered a player by the name of Lenny Tristano. And I listened to a piece called Lineup. And I listened to it and I said, my God, that's The Train.
So I guess what I want to ask you is, I mean, you are so successful and your music is so beloved by many, but I'm wondering how you react to some of the early reactions to your music. I mean, you write about how, say, friends in France talked about music that you'd written for a Samuel Beckett play, and they said, but it's not music. And others have described your work as a needle being stuck in a groove. And you write about how one composer once said that if you take a C major chord and just play it over and over again, that's what Philip Glass does. I mean, how do you react to all that?
Well, I understand that they are not hearing the music. I mean, when I was a young guy, I walked into a museum and I saw for the first time a painting by Frank Stella. And I had been brought up looking at Jackson Pollock. Suddenly, everything was different. And at first, I couldn't see the painting. I couldn't see it for what it was because I was immersed in something else. And I think that's what happens very often with the music we love becomes the music we know. And the music we know becomes the music we love. And so that when something comes along that steps out in a different way, you literally cannot hear it. So when someone says, the needle stuck in the groove, I said, well, actually, their mind is stuck in the groove, but either they'll get it eventually or they won't.
Well, I wonder, do you know the answer to a question that you yourself pose in the memoir, which is, where does music come from? You said that's the reason why you wanted to get into composition at all.
Yeah, I wanted to know where music came from, so I decided I would start writing music and find out. And I never, from those experiences, I never found out. But the question changed over the years, and actually various forms of the answer changed. I often give talks to whatever students are around. It could be a composition class or it could be a dance class. And I was talking to the students, and someone said to me, "What is music?" You know, this is one of those things where I didn't know what I was going to say, and I listened to myself saying it, kind of astonished. And I said, "Music is a place. It's as real as Chicago or New York or your house in the country. It's a place. And people who are musicians go to that place, and they live in that place."
Well, the new memoir is Words Without Music. It is a wonderful recounting of Philip Glass's life by Philip Glass himself. Thank you so much for sharing your stories and your time with us today.
Thank you very much, Meghna. It was a pleasure to talk with you.